Our second case this morning is 2021-47, 2021-169, and 2021-136. State Ex Rel, the Cincinnati Enquirer, Division of Gannett GP Media Incorporated. State of Ohio, Ex Rel Eugene Volek, and the State Ex Rel, the Cincinnati Enquirer, all versus the Honorable Megan Shanahan. For the appellants, Mr. Ford.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court.
You can take your mask off, Mr. Ford.
My apologies, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Darren Ford. I represent the Cincinnati Enquirer, along with my colleague, Jack Reiner. I'm also joined at council table by Mr. Nye, who represents Professor Eugene Volek. I will be splitting time with Mr. Nye this morning. I will speak for 3 minutes. He will speak for the balance, and we would reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. We would ask this court to grant the writs of mandamus and prohibition requested by the parties in this action. I'm going to limit my argument this morning to the question whether the Cincinnati Enquirer had an obligation to file a Superintendent's Rule 45F motion to request that respondent Judge Megan Shanahan unrestrict public access to Officer MR's affidavit after respondent entered her September 16, 2020 sealing order. The language of Superintendent's Rule 47B permits a party aggrieved by a court's failure to comply with Superintendent's Rule 45E to pursue an action in mandamus to vindicate the public's right of access to court records protected by the First Amendment. Neither Superintendent's Rule 47B nor any other rule imposes a requirement on a relator to first file a motion of any sort with the court that restricted access. And Superintendent's Rule 45F is an opposite when the validity of the order restricting public access, in this case, respondent's September 16, 2020 order, is being challenged, as in these cases. This is so based on the plain language of Superintendent's Rule 45F, which requires a person seeking to unrestrict access to demonstrate, by clear and convincing evidence, that the presumption of public access is no longer outweighed by a higher interest. Relators in this action assert that the September 16, 2020 order restricting public access does not comply with Superintendent's Rule 45E or the First Amendment because the presumption of public access was never outweighed by a higher interest. Filing a Superintendent's Rule 45F motion to challenge the September 16 sealing order would have required the Enquirer to make an argument on the premise that a higher interest had at some point outweighed the presumption of public interest, an argument that it does not advance in this mandamus action challenging that order. Despite respondents' contention to the contrary, the Enquirer did not have an adequate remedy at law through a Superintendent's Rule 45F motion. And Superintendent's Rule 45F has no application in this case.
Well, do the rules of superintendents apply at all to the issue of proceeding under a pseudonym?
Arguably no, Your Honor. But they certainly do apply to the issue of whether or not she properly, in her September 16, 2020 order, restricted access to the exhibits to his affidavit. That's certainly a court record. It was under seal. So arguably, and we've argued this in our brief as well, prohibition as to the pseudonymity issue is really the proper writ for that. But at least to the affidavit, Superintendent's Rule 45E applied, and a Superintendent's Rule 47B mandamus action would be proper to challenge that order. Of course, reading Superintendent's Rule 45F to require a relator to first bring that motion, especially when the burden is on the movant who is seeking to obtain access to show by clear and convincing evidence that this higher interest or alleged higher interest is no longer exists, that would create consistency problems with the First Amendment. But the court need not read Superintendent's Rule 45E or 45F to require that, and therefore we would simply ask that in this case the court find that the Enquirer satisfied its requirements in order to bring this mandamus action challenging the restrictions on the affidavit that Judge Shanahan imposed in her September 16, 2020 sealing order. And if the court doesn't have any further questions, I would yield the remaining time to Mr. Nye.
I do. You mentioned 47B. 47B says mandamus pursuant to Chapter 2731.
Yes, Your Honor.
2731.05 says the writ must not be issued when there's an adequate remedy at law.
Yes, Your Honor, correct.
And isn't then the argument that you then have to go back to the motion under 45? That is your remedy at law.
if 45F used language that simply required a relator to make an objection to the court, to simply say, I object to this sealing order. But the burden under 45F, the language of 45F is very clear. It presumes that there was a valid sealing order in the first instance, and then it imposes the burden on the movement to say that interest either no longer exists or there's some other reason why the court should order or should lift that order. The First Amendment doesn't impose that level of burden on a movement to challenge a sealing order. So to read 45F as a prerequisite to bringing an action would be to say that now the burden is on the movement to demonstrate that the circumstances no longer exist. So while yes, the mandamus statute requires an adequate remedy of law, Superintendent's Rule 45F, the language of that rule, presumes a valid order, which would essentially write out the ability of a movement to challenge the validity of a sealing order in the first instance.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jeff Nye on behalf of Relator Eugene Volokh. I agree with everything Mr. Ford said. There's nothing in the text of the rules that requires a party to proceed under Superintendent's Rule 45 before seeking mandamus under 47B. I'll just add that if that were required, my client did proceed in the trial court before filing the mandamus action. We didn't get the relief we requested. As a non-party, we could not appeal that order. If a defendant had joined in that motion, a defendant may have a right of appeal. As a non-parties member of the public, we do not. 47B says any person who is affected. That's not limited to the parties. More broadly, the public's business must be done in public. We have a long common law and constitutional tradition of public access to court records. The public has a right and duty to supervise its public officials. And where those two interests intersect, we have in this case a public official who is trying to restrict public access to court records, and that should never be permitted in this circumstance. This case isn't about whether those rights exist. All the parties agree that they do. It's about what the mechanism for enforcement is and whether the respondent complied with that mechanism. The mechanism is in Superintendent's Rule 45E. There are three requirements. One is that the court must give notice to all the parties. The second is that there must be clear and convincing evidence. The third is that there must be clear and convincing evidence of some higher interest that outweighs the presumption of public access. Now, 45E does not say what those higher interests are, but the case law does. Everyone has cited Doe versus Bruner. It's a 12th District case that canvassed federal case law and identified a list of factors that might outweigh inappropriate circumstances. We'd ask the court to adopt paragraph 7 of Bruner as the law of Ohio, setting forth what some of those factors are. Most of them aren't at issue here. The plaintiffs aren't children. There's no disclosure of issues of utmost intimacy. The plaintiff isn't disclosing an intent to violate the law. The plaintiff isn't challenging governmental conduct. The only one that's arguably at issue is a threat of retaliation. But what MR and the respondent in this case missed is that a threat of retaliation must be for challenging governmental conduct or for filing this lawsuit. So if you look at the case law that Bruner cites, there's a Sixth Circuit case called Doe versus Porter, a Fifth Circuit case called Doe versus Stiegel. Those cases both happen to be challenging school prayer policies. And there's actual evidence in the record of specific threats made against those plaintiffs for challenging those policies and for filing the lawsuit. There are letters to the editor saying, you hurt me and now I'm going to hurt you. I believe I think it was the Stiegel case, someone is saying at a public school board meeting, when we find out who this is, we're going to get you, that sort of thing. There is nothing like that in this case. I understand that MR is trying to characterize his affidavit as having some sort of threats. I think the court will appreciate that I don't have access to that entire affidavit. The exhibits are still sealed, part of the averments are still sealed. I don't know what else might be in there, but in the way they're described in the affidavit and the way they're described by counsel in the proceedings below is that they are false statements of fact. There are no threats. There are certainly no threats of retaliation.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. You, your client is the previous...
Yes, we heard from him here this morning.
Yes, who said there's no circumstances under which that the there would be protected that this that a TRO or a, you know, any injunction would be appropriate. That speech is always allowable. Information sharing is always allowable.
So I would say a couple of things about that. We're here on the sealing order, not the prior restraining, so there may be a distinction between
right.
those two. I would say, however, that there is certainly a presumption that any order that restricts speech is unconstitutional, and the burden ought to be on the party seeking to restrict the speech to show which category of protected speech it falls into, whether it's a true threat, whether there might be some national security concern. I really can't imagine what that would be. I think the court could say categorically that a public official can never proceed under a pseudonym in a case seeking to stifle criticism of his official on-duty conduct. That's what our constitutional tradition requires. We hold public officials to a higher standard. That's New York Times versus Sullivan, right? A public official must show a higher degree of fault than a private figure plaintiff would in a defamation context. The same principle applies here. I think the court can and should make that categorical ruling. However, if the court is not inclined to go that far, it can certainly say that in this case, on these facts, there is not clear and convincing evidence that would justify the use of a pseudonym. One of the questions that I get when I talk about this case with lawyers is what should have happened. You know, forget MR. Suppose there is a child plaintiff or there is a matter of utmost intimacy. How do you proceed? Here is how it should happen. A plaintiff who thinks they should proceed anonymously should file a complaint under a pseudonym. They should contemporaneously file a motion for leave to proceed under a pseudonym. Now, MR did that here, and so far, so good. But then the court should give notice to all the defendants. The court should conduct an evidentiary hearing to accept clear and convincing evidence. Affidavits are not enough. Now, I know it's a different context, but this court has said that affidavits, allegations and affidavits are not sufficient to establish clear and convincing evidence to take away a law license. If it's not enough to take away the privilege of practicing law, it can't be enough to overcome the constitutional presumption of public access to court records. The court should conduct an evidentiary hearing, it should put a witness on the stand, it should require the plaintiff to present the clear and convincing evidence. They should be subjected to cross-examination. If there's no one there to cross, the court, as the guardian of the public's right of access, should question the witness. If there is a higher interest, they should specifically state what it is in the order. They should make specific findings of fact. They should use the least restrictive means available, and they should make that order public.
None. Counsel, should that hearing take place in open court?
It should, absolutely.
Well, then a reporter can be there, and they're going to hear the evidence that...
And that is indeed the norm. In other contexts where there is sensitive evidence that needs to be presented out of the public eye, the public is momentarily excused from the room, so the court can make that determination. It's important that it be public not only so the defendants have an opportunity to object if they choose to, but so the public does, so the public can be there. If we had been advised before this hearing had happened, this ex parte hearing, maybe wouldn't be here today. The public needs to be represented at that hearing. In the event that a motion isn't filed with the complaint, the court should issue a show cause order or a motion, an order to replead under Rule 10A or something like that. It might happen administratively as part of the case intake. It might happen at a 16B conference or a case management conference. The important point is that it must happen before the court exercises coercive power. Cincinnati Gas and Electric versus GE, it's a Sixth Circuit case we cite. They say the right of public access attaches when the court exercises coercive power. So a summary jury trial, for example, is not a public proceeding. But if the court's going to enter a temporary restraining order, and in particular a temporary restraining order that we contend is a prior restraint, it must resolve that pseudonymity and public access issue first, and it must do it through clear and convincing evidence. I think I'm into my rebuttal time, so unless there's any questions, I'll sit down. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Sears?
Yes, ma'am. May it please the court. Pamela Sears for the respondent, your inferior judge, Judge Megan Shanahan. In this case, Your Honors, I submit to you that your inferior judge deftly structured and crafted an order to address a rather unique threat of risk of harm to persons in the form of doxing. And I would submit that this court can take judicial notice of doxing, which I would submit to you is the practice of publicizing on social media and elsewhere personal identifying information of persons that in that same effort are characterized as, I would submit, subhuman by being something of an ist, some kind of misogynist, fascist,
so,
Nazi,
so what,
or racist.
What is, what is the public interest at this point? I mean, the identity of MR has been published.
Yes.
I mean, why is there any, you know, what does this order accomplish? You're not protecting anyone at this point,
so
right?
So that's the gravamen of actually of my argument, and I thank you very much for asking it. Because I would submit to you that the orders that this court entered into in this case, and the order that she did not enter into in this case, that the mechanistic interplay of those orders specifically addresses the threat to persons of doxing. So I think that's where...
Okay, but you couldn't, 2 minutes on Google, you can figure out who the officer is. So it's not protecting anyone anymore, is it?
Well, if you'll permit me, Judge, my argument is this, and I have to disagree with prior counsel that argued to you, and I have to adopt at least the questioning of the Chief Justice. To my view and to my way of looking at this, there is nothing in this judge's initial orders that prevent any party defendant in this case from characterizing the plaintiff in this case in any fashion he or she would like to. They can comment on his morality. They could comment on his character.
How do you know that? She didn't define what a personal identifier is, so she painted it with the broadest brush possible. So how could you stand there and say that? But to Justice DeWine's point, everybody knows, 2 minute search, who MR is.
Correct.
But the case file still says MR.
Correct.
That has not been changed, and the affidavit is still partially sealed.
Correct.
So why shouldn't we be focusing on those issues?
To your first question, how can I say that? The judge in this case specifically allowed the social media posting that characterized this plaintiff as a white supremacist in conjunction with his behavior to stand. She did not remove that post. So that's why, Your Honor, with all due respect, I stand before you and say, on this record,
That would be a different First Amendment restriction.
Correct.
Were she to have said, all of you must leave here today and redact from all social media channels anything you have said about MR.
Right.
That would be different than what she did, which says, from this day forward, you cannot post a personal identifier. And she didn't define what a personal identifier is.
So, Your Honor, to my point, what I'm suggesting to you is that the juxtaposition between your observation that there was no prior restraint by this judge on any kind of characterization of this plaintiff, but at the same time, with regard to the same party's defendant, there is a limitation on whether they can, in conjunction with that characterization of this person as a white supremacist, identify him personally. And I would agree with you on this record. No one challenged the judge to further define it. I would concede that. But I would also suggest that in this context, when we look at doxing, that we know what that is. Name, address, place of work, spouse, children's names.
But
those are the things that I believe. I'm sorry.
But wasn't,
oh, I'm sorry,
what, the, wasn't what the judge, the trial judge, taking judicial notice of was an uptick in violence against the police? Was she taking, you want us to take judicial notice of doxing, but is that what the trial court did? I thought her basis for continuing this order was taking judicial notice of an uptick in violence against police.
You're quite right, Your Honor, that the court did note that at least once and maybe more than once in the record. But also, I reread the transcripts of the July 22nd, 24th, and September 16th hearings again just a couple days ago. And there specifically is a reference by the judge to doxing. And back to Judge DeWine's point and Justice Kennedy's point, when the sort of lack of ability to marry that characterization of this person in a manner which would invite negative consequences to him, which would invite really a call to arms. And unfortunately, in our world today, a call to violence to some degree, to a person. So when she issued an order that said that you can publish anything you want about these proceedings, I'm not going to restrict your First Amendment rights to characterize this case or characterize this plaintiff in any way, but in those postings, you're not simultaneously going to identify him by his personal information, which you're quite right, if I took the effort to Google, but what we have here, I think, is quite a deft order specifically preventing parties defendant from publishing characterizations of someone that would invite negative consequences from third parties, unknown third parties out in the crazy land of the blogosphere, would invite potential violence to this person. So I'm going to order you, parties defendant, that you cannot join those characterizations of this person as a racist and white supremacist, which is abhorrent, right, and which invites and could potentially invite harm to him or his family. I'm not going to allow you to marry those characterizations with his personal identifying information. Okay, and so, frankly, so oh, the, sorry, Judge.
Was, so I'm the last, so, oh, sorry, the, Justice. The, going to what Justice Kennedy was saying,
yes.
The lack of specificity on what personal information means, the appellees so far today have basically pushed that off on the parties who've either filed the action or been the appellant in the action and said they didn't get any more specificity or clarification from the trial judge. But wouldn't your client want that to be specific so that the order sticks?
Well, what's interesting to me about that comment was what Mr. Gottesman said, and if you'll recall, he said, we all knew it, because all of the parties to this case had unredacted copies of the affidavit. So everyone that was litigating this case in terms of being parties to this case had this knowledge. And so I can't speak for the parties. I can't even speak for the judge's reasoning. I'm representing her in terms of what she did.
That's not the answer to my question,
though. I'm sorry. Maybe I didn't
understand
it.
My question is, wouldn't your client and MR want that kind of specificity? I mean, so far everyone seems to say, well, the people who brought this action, it was their job to get the judge to be more specific, but wouldn't you want it too?
I guess what I'm saying, Your Honor, I wasn't there. I wasn't a party to the litigation, but I would have to rely on what Mr. Gottesman's representation was, that everyone had access to the affidavit. They had access to the content of the posting. And so I can only suggest to you that there was, at least from the party's perspective, clarification on that. I don't have any better answer for you. I apologize.
My question is, in terms of what constitutes personal information, is it just the name? Is it the Social Security numbers? Is it the date of birth? Do you know what your client meant?
I haven't seen the material that's sealed and redacted in this case, because I didn't think it would be appropriate for me to see it and then perhaps blurt it out. So I have never seen the social media posting that Mr. Gottesman has seen. So in terms of, I can only suggest to you that in light of the fact that the parties didn't pursue it, that there must be something in the material that was presented to the court that made the parties at least have a notion and an idea and could answer that question for you.
And I guess
I'm sorry.
Doesn't an order restraining speech need to be narrowly tailored?
Yes.
Okay.
So, which brings me to the pseudonym itself. So, in terms of your question, Justice DeWine. So, again, when I say that this court deftly crafted this order, I mean that sincerely. Because, for example, in the parties who are free to characterize parties defendant, this plaintiff in any negative way that they choose on social media or elsewhere, if they were to include the case number, then that person could simply run the case number in the Hamilton County Clerk of Courts website, and again, MR would be identified. Again, what I would suggest to you, that by ordering the pseudonym, by precluding the publication by parties defendant, and only by parties defendant, I might add, to publish identifying information about this plaintiff, that this court navigated the minefield, which is the realization that the public has access to our courts, and that...
So, counsel, any other newspaper or news service could publish his name?
Yes.
Right now?
Yes. And as I understand, I haven't seen it because I didn't read it, but I understand the Cincinnati Inquirer did that this morning. So to my way of thinking, the Cincinnati Enquirer is not publishing information to dox MR. They are not publishing facts concerning the case in order to invite negative consequences to MR by characterizing him as a white supremacist. The party's defendants are free to do that because this is America.
Well, so the difference between publishing and doxing really is intent, right? So don't you have to have evidence for intent?
Yes, and I understand that you have it here, that you have that there is, at least from my reading of the record, there was a social meeting posting of a party defendant in this case talking about doing exactly that. So yes, in fact, Justice, that's exactly my point. This is not some vague, veiled threat that somewhere somebody in a basement might Google this case, find out this person, and show up at his child's schoolyard. This is a party defendant discussing in the context of characterizing this person.
So how does this order keep that defendant from doing that? This defendant knows who the police officer is.
You mean someone out in Google land, or you mean this particular defendant?
Well, anyone. I guess I'm just kind of befuddled how an order keeping a name off of a lawsuit that's publicly available information, how there's any public interest in doing that.
I keep coming back to my position that it's the marriage of the characterization and the social.
It's because people are a lot more likely to find something by going on the Hamilton County Clerk of Court's website than reading the newspaper?
No. I post a social media post characterizing someone as subhuman, as some racist white supremacist that deserves negative consequences. Those negative consequences could be his employment. Those negative consequences to someone out in the world could be showing up at his child's schoolyard and some degree of harm.
Okay, order doesn't prevent any of that here.
Yes, it actually does. It prevents the party defendants from marrying identifying information of this plaintiff with characterizations of this plaintiff that would invite call to arms and calls to violence. I'm not saying that the party's defendant want anything bad to happen to this person. You have in your Rule 45E a risk of harm to persons. It's our position that this court considered that potential risk of harm to persons and created an order that deftly navigated that minefield. I have to concede to you that if there's some person out there that's not in our presence right now, that wants to hurt people, that we are limited in our ability to control that.
But that's not what the Cincinnati Enquirer wants here.
No.
What they want is for the court to issue an order that would properly name the plaintiff and remove the pseudonym of MR.
Yes.
And they want those four sections of the affidavit revealed.
Yes. And what I'm suggesting to you, it is that the pseudonym is tied to the mechanization of the doxing, and that's why the order was entered. So, with regard to the Cincinnati Enquirer, they have published the name of this person. They know the name of this person, but there is not the...
Why shouldn't the court just correct the record and put the individual's name on the face of the complaint?
Because, again, I would suggest to you that because there is no prior restraint of the party's abilities to characterize this person as someone who's deserving of a response of negative consequences or violence and marrying that post with identifying information or the case number, that what the court viewed as protecting a risk of harm to persons was the use of the pseudonym. So that if a party defendant negatively characterizes the defendant, which they're certainly entitled to do and have their opinion, and they conclude the case number and someone runs that case number, they're not going to be able to readily identify the party plaintiff. And to that degree, only, and I realize it's not fail-safe, we only have to look at the news of the day to understand what some people are willing to do in order to intimidate and affect people, third parties out there unknown to us.
So
but to the extent that the court can control the judicial process, to the extent that the court can ensure that at least its administration of the proceeding will protect litigants during the course of the proceeding from proceeding with their causes of action, the court has an obligation, I believe, and a responsibility to do that.
How were the Facebook posts authenticated?
First of all, I don't think anyone objected to the Facebook post as being authentic.
It wasn't stipulated evidence, was it?
I don't think it was objected to, and I, think it would be a statement of a party opponent against interest. So to the extent that there was an argument of hearsay, I don't even think it fits the definition of hearsay itself. But in terms of—
I assume that the defendants testified at the hearing?
I don't believe there was any testimony taken.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
So how did they authenticate the Facebook post to prove that she could take judicial notice of doxing?
I don't think that that necessarily follows. The taking judicial notice of doxing is the practice of doxing. In terms of the evidence itself, it was offered in an affidavit. I don't think any one of the parties at any point in the proceeding, including Enquirer or Volek, ever suggested that that wasn't actually a posting of the defendant. No.
Well,
in fact, it was specifically argued at the September 16th hearing, not that it wasn't his statement, but that it didn't constitute a threat as was argued to the court and as the court suggested it was.
But I thought that the defendants in the prior action did not have access to the exhibits to the affidavit. So did they know that the Facebook posts that the judge had before her were correct?
My understanding is that I wasn't there. My understanding from the record is, in fact, the parties defendant to the case had unredacted affidavit as well as the exhibits, and they were able to substantively argue the content of those exhibits, and you can see that from the record. So I do believe that from the record you can glean that everyone had, parties defendant had knowledge of the content of those exhibits and that Facebook post, and they actually argued the content of it in the July 24th hearing. Certainly, there was argument concerning the actual content of it. In fact, when Professor Volek criticizes the court for a lack of notice under 45E, there were no parties. It was a TRO ex parte hearing initially on July 16th. So there were no parties to notice. So what happened was Mr. Gottesen was determined to be a process server and his colleague, and they served all putative parties. And those putative parties had an opportunity to come on July 24th. In fact, if you look at the record, putative parties that actually had not even been served were present at court, and some were represented by counsel. So there certainly was an effort by the court to make sure that everyone had access to all of that information and an ability to challenge it, which I think, to your point, Justice, I hear that that may be your concern, that there was an opportunity to challenge that evidence. And I think when you look at the record, there was that. Much more than expired.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, you've reserved a minute and 42 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice DeWine, to your point about his name being known, his likely identity has been reported. That's certainly a factor that weighs in favor of unsealing the record. Doe versus FBI, the great case named Sealed Plaintiff versus Sealed Defendant, the Soak case, the Garrison case, they say the identity of a public official is important, and when an identity has already been revealed, that weighs against continued sealing. If we pretend that he's anonymous, then we are being complicit in the misinformation of the public. The court shouldn't permit that. It's certainly true that probably anyone could Google and determine his likely identity. We have a right of public access to court records and to identify public officials who are using the court system. It's not a right of access to court records as described by news reports. I think I would add, too, that the reporting about MR's identity is, as I understand, and it's in the record. We didn't put those articles in the record, but the respondent did at Shanahan's submission 323 to 339. You can read those articles. The reporter determined the identity by reading the allegations in MR's complaint. He says, someone filed a CCA, a Citizen Complaint Authority complaint against me on this date. The reporter went and got the complaint and got his name that way. It's pure fiction that he is trying to remain anonymous, and we shouldn't permit him to do it. I know that I'm just about out of time, so unless there are any other questions, we'd ask you to issue the writs of mandamus and prohibition forthwith.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess?
All rise.